The Guardian.
I want to talk to you about Antonio Stradivari. If you go to his Wikipedia page, there's a painting of Antonio. He's sitting in his workshop wearing a red velvet overcoat and billowing white shirt. Around him are various pieces of violin. But he's considering only one violin for the moment, his arm outstretched, his brow furrowed, his fingers flexed around his chin. Antonio Stradivari lived in a small Italian town known as Cremona. And it was here, in the late 1600s, that he made some of the most beautiful sounding violins in the world. Around 500 of his violins survive today, and they sell for millions. Some have tried to replicate that sweet sound of a Strad, but it has been one of the most enduring mysteries for both luthiers and scientists alike. There is, however, an increasing body of work that suggests the cellular structure of wood is one of the most important factors.
If you want to build a good violin, you have to select wood with very high tonal properties.
And to recreate this kind of wood, Francis has been using fungi. This time, we explore the amazing feats of fungi, how they've saved thousands of lives, provided us with food as well as vitamin D, and ask, why is this kingdom of life so underexplored?
It's totally untapped, and it's probably one of the most exciting kingdoms for us to be studying right now in order to address global challenges.
I'm Hannah Devlin, and this is Science Weekly.
The next station is Kew Gardens.
First, our producer Greya went to meet Kathy Willis, the Director of Science at the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew.
Okay, so we'll just go into this large door down here. And we're just coming into Kew's fungarium. And the fungarium, this was established in 1879,
and we now have about 1.25 million specimens in here, so it's the largest fungarium in the world. And when people think about Kew, they think about plants, understand it's a botanic garden. What they don't realise is that we have the world's best collection of fungi as well.
Okay. Greya tells me that the fungarium looked a bit like a massive shoe shop.
Yeah, it's got a ton of these green boxes stacked right up to the ceiling. And then each box has a load of fungi in it, pressed between sheets of paper. Actually, it's a bit like, did you ever press and dry flowers together when you were a kid?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a bit like that. And then some of the fungi are also in glass boxes rather than pressed. But everything we looked at, it all looked really different. Some of them are white, some of them are black, some of them are shiny, some of them were tiny, bigger, smaller. A huge array of different types of fungus.
Perplexed at the variety, Greya wants to know just what fungi are.
So fungi are one of the major kingdoms of life on Earth, and people often don't realise that. They normally lump them with plants. They think they're some lower order plant like a moss or an algae. But they're not. They are actually closer to animals than to plants. So when people think of fungi, they tend to think of mould. And they sit, you know, mould on your shower curtain. They think of, I'm afraid, I hope people aren't eating their breakfast, but they think of athlete's foot. They think of, a number of sort of things like the rust on the rose leaves. However, there's a much bigger kingdom than that. There are 8 phyla in there, and they go right the way from your mushrooms and your brackets that you see, you know, growing out from trees, through to your yeasts and your tiny, tiny fungi that you'll find growing inside cells, inside guts, between cells. You know, most fungi you can't see with the naked eye. What we're seeing, the things we see with the naked eye are the spore-bearing structures of basically a couple of groups, a couple of the phyla.
This week you've launched a report called The State of the World's Fungus. Can you just tell me a bit more about that and what you've found, what the top lines are?
So this is our third report from Kew. We did two State of the World's Plants where we pulled together international specialists to really give us a baseline on where we are with plants. And then we have this incredible fungarium and all this, you know, this incredible collection. And we thought we can't put plants and fungi together because they're separate kingdoms. And so we said, why don't we do a State of the World's Fungi? And then we realised no one has done that before. So it's really asking, you know, how many species of fungi are there? Where are they distributed? What is good about fungi? But also, what do we know about those fungi that really are destroying many ecosystems across the world? And you don't have to look far to see ash dieback, for example, would be a classic example. And then finally to say, and going forwards, what do we need to be worrying about? So in terms of climate change and in terms of conservation of fungi.
Can we have a look in some of these boxes?
Yes,
and because what struck me through the research of this podcast is that fungus do an amazing array of things. And I'm wondering if you can just give me a sense of what those amazing things are.
So they go from the good to the bad. So the good, many of the drugs that we use are underpinned by fungi. So statins, which you take to lower cholesterol in blood. Many people will take those. They are fungal-based. Penicillin is a really good one. But also some of the immunosuppressant drugs. For example, those that when you have an organ transplant, that whole area of medicine has been transformed by the discovery of immunosuppressant drugs, which are fungal-based. I can show you some, actually. They're at the other end.
Great.
OK, so if we open this box here, for example, you have to lift the lid up, you'll see... get the sheets out here. What we have here is cordyceps, and cordyceps is a really interesting group of fungi because they do really horrible things and really good things. So the horrible things, so let me show you this example here. So this, what we've got, about a 10 centimeter long caterpillar, and you can see this disgusting thing growing out of its head, and that is the fungi. So the fungi basically invades the body of the caterpillar and then exudes and grows out of its head. Now you think, oh, crumbs, that's horrible. However, in the same family of this fungi is one of the most important drugs that we now know for organ transplant. And the immunosuppressant classes of drugs all come from this family. And so it's both the good and the bad, the Jekyll and the Hyde, that we're seeing each and every time when you look at the fungal families.
I mean, it just shows.
But as well as highlighting the good, the bad and the ugly, this report also showed just how little we know about this kingdom of life.
Exactly, it's a really hard one. So right now, current estimates are basically around 3 million species that we know of, but it's probably much, much more than that. You know, people who do soil sampling keep finding hundreds of species from their molecular signature in the soil. And of those, you know, 3 million, we've named about 5%. So it's a really, really unknown kingdom.
Why is that?
Not many people have worked on fungi in comparison to plants and animals, partly because you can't see them, partly because, as you've been alluding to, often you think of fungi, you think of, you know, the mould on your shower curtain or the mouldy bread. You don't think of them as being incredibly important.
And you alluded to the fact that fungi aren't, but are they well described within that category? I know sometimes.
But even the 5% scientists have categorised and named, they're not as well defined as you might think. One of Cathy's colleagues bought some porcini mushrooms from a shop in London.
Yeah. Let's get one out of here, yeah. The bilitis is a fungi, as you can see, you know.
The Latin name for porcini is bilitis.
You know, about, what, 5, 10 centimetres tall, with a very big sort of spore-bearing structure cap on top. Anyway, so
They brought it back to the lab and did some DNA analysis.
But instead of one species coming back, he found three new species, totally new to science. And then, of course, once you've found three new species, you then need to name the species. One of them is called cattle liver fungus, which to me doesn't sound like the most edible of fungi to eat. But I mean, I think to me it also really indicates how important it is that we do a lot more work on not only the things we're eating, but also just understanding the diversity and distribution of fungi.
Quick question just to get out of the way there. Does that mean they're poisonous or
dangerous or?
No, I don't. Yes, I don't know. They're certainly not poisonous or dangerous as far as we know. But I think what it does raise is those alarm bells, is to say, you know, we often worry about when we're doing DNA of meat and saying, oh my goodness, you know, this meat is not from a cow, it's from a horse. Well, actually, when we're having our porcini mushrooms, our porcini risotto, we possibly need to think about what we're eating there.
Absolutely, because this is something that supposedly we have already identified.
Yes.
So fungus has a bad reputation, but, you know, when we started talking, you named such a wide variety of great things that fungus can do. I just wondered whether maybe it's a bit untapped as a field, of perhaps it might solve some of our many problems in the future if we can continue to understand this unknown kingdom of fungus.
I would take it further than that. It's totally untapped, and it's probably one of the most exciting kingdoms for us to be studying right now in order to address global challenges. So there are things, for example, like fungi now that break down plastic. How important is that going to be? And they break it down in a matter of weeks. There was a very nice study last year done on recycling a refuse heap in Pakistan, and they found a new species of fungi that breaks down the plastic. We've got fungi that now create a really, really good biofuel. And then you go through to the foods. So many people now are moving to plant-based and vegan-based diet. Tofu, tempeh, all of these things, they're fungal-based. And even Marmite is fungal-based, you know, like it or hate it, but it's one of those ones that people, you know, and so there are so many things. And then you go on to the drugs. You think of all those drugs we rely on, from the basics of penicillin through to when you're doing these, you know, very advanced transplants of organs. All of those rely on fungi in order to make them successful. So absolutely, at our peril, do we ignore fungi.
Great. Thank you so much, Kathy.
Okay. It's a pleasure. Absolute pleasure.
How many of these entries have you done?
Too many.
Has anyone said they've had a really fun time in Funganarium or whatever it's called? Has that been used yet?
No, I haven't had that one yet.
Fungarium. Yes.
Having fun in the Fungarium.
One person who has begun to tap into fungi is Francis Schwartz. He used them to perfect the structural properties of wood, and in turn used them to create violins. But what would happen when he pitted his fungal-treated violin against a world-famous Stradivarius?
So after he played on these five violins, we asked the audience, which violin do you think was the Stradivarius?
We'll be back in a minute with what happened after the break.
Hello, it's Ian Sample here. I just wanted to let you know The Guardian curates a series of live events, and there's some science ones in the pipeline that we thought might interest you. For instance, transhumanism, the extraordinary movement that seeks to cheat death and use technology to live forever. In October, the author Mark O'Connell will be coming to London to talk about its highest profile members, from the ultra-rich gatekeepers of Silicon Valley, such as Elon Musk and PayPal co-founder Peter Thiel, to small-town libertarians experimenting with technological implants. For 3 years, O'Connell has journeyed among biohackers, cryogenicists, and scientists seeking to use technology for human evolution. His thoughts and conclusions? Well, you'll have to go to the talk, won't you? To find out more about dates, tickets and timings, head over to theguardian.com/podcasts and navigate to the Science Weekly page. That's theguardian.com/podcasts.
I'm Hannah Devlin, and welcome back to Science Weekly. Before the break, Kathy highlighted how fungus has been the cause of great destruction, but also a lot of good. She also talked about how fungi are one of the biggest untapped resources at our fingertips, like how there's this fungus that breaks down plastic, or another one that can be used as a biofuel. But how about making violins sound great? Hello.
Hi, Hannah. Hi. Oh,
sorry, you can hear me, but I can't hear you because I've not got my headphones on yet.
Okay, good. Well, then I'll wait a second or two.
Hiya, now I can hear you.
Hi, Hanya.
Okay, so Francis, could you just start by introducing yourself so we've got you on the recording with your title?
Well, my name is Francis Schwarzer and I work at the EMPA in St. Gallen. It's a federal research institute for material research and science. And I'm head of the research group Bioengineered Wood.
Francis lives and works in Switzerland as a wood anatomist and mycologist or fungi expert, which seems like quite a jump to helping make violins. So what I wanted to know was, how did you get so interested in this stringed instrument?
Well, to be honest, it was a chance meeting with a very famous violin maker, Martin Schleske. And obviously, I was intrigued to hear and experience more about the secrets of building a good violin. So I had a lot of questions and he was very kind and took a lot of time to explain me what it takes to make a good violin.
So when you had this chance encounter, what did you learn about the Stradivari violin and the Cremonese violin makers?
Well, the first thing I learned from Martin Schleske is really that if you want to build a good violin, you have to select wood with very high tonal properties. And most violin makers, whenever they select wood, they have a closer look at the wood. They perhaps may weigh the wood to get an indication of how dense the wood is.
The wood is a really important part of the violin making process. Violin makers are especially interested in the density or how tightly the cells in the wood are packed together.
The wood preferably should have a low density, for example.
But it's not just a low density, but also how uniform that density is. The speed of sound is affected by these two factors, as well as how stiff the wood is. The stiffer, lighter, and more uniformly dense a piece of wood is, the faster the speed of sound. Nail that, and the results are a special sounding set of strings. Now, exactly what makes Stradivarius violins sound so beautiful is contentious, but some believe that the consistent density of the wood is an important factor.
So, in other words, the wood structure is very, very regular, and the cell walls have a very similar thinness.
So why can't we just grow trees that are uniformly dense and then make violins like Stradivari did?
Because a number of scientific studies do show that the majority of wood that was used to make these superior tonal violins was wood that was selected during the Maunder Minimum, which was a little ice age. So during this little ice age, what was typical was that the winters were very long and cold, the summers were very short. So the trees growing at high elevations, and this is where we find high quality tone wood, they were growing very slowly, the anner rings were very narrow, and the density was a lot lower than the wood we can find today during times of global warming.
The Little Ice Age was around the time that Stradivari was making violins. It was about 1 degree centigrade cooler than today, so not as cold as you might think for an ice age. But studies have shown that this temperature drop is enough to create the kind of wood that's perfect for violins. Today, these conditions aren't as commonplace, and this got Francis wondering, is there any other way he could recreate this type of wood? He thought that the answer might lie in fungus.
Well, I studied tree pathology, and I was always very interested in how wood decay fungi alter certain properties of the wood. And my background is also arboriculture, and in arboriculture, you quite often find that trees are decayed, and then you have different methods for assessing internal decay. And one method that was used is measuring the velocity of sound, because
This is how tree surgeons measure rot, as trees can rot from the inside out. Generally, sound travels faster through hard, healthy wood and then slower in soft wood that's been attacked by fungus. But what Francis found was a couple of types of fungi that didn't decrease the speed of sound, but degraded the wood a little, making it lighter in density, but also keeping its stiff structure. Bingo.
So the special aspect about this decay is that the cell walls become thinner, but the walls are not completely degraded. So you have a rich skeleton in the wood, and the sound waves can still travel directly through the wood.
And so how do you treat the wood with the fungus? Presumably you don't want, someone wouldn't want to buy a violin that was sort of rotting away.
This was exactly the discussion I had with Martin Schleske, because I remember his face. He was completely shocked, and I think he imagined a hollow tree, and that's what he would imagine would happen to the wood eventually, that it would completely decompose. So you have to eliminate the growth of the fungus at a defined time.
And how do you do that?
Well, we sterilize the wood with ethylene oxide. It's also used in medicine for sterilizing medical equipment.
Francis conducted a blind test to see what would happen if he pitted his fungal-treated violin against a world-famous Stradivarius. There were five violins in the running. Two of Francis's fungal-treated violins, one had been treated for 6 months, the other for 9 months. Two untreated violins made from the same tree and the same luthier, just no fungi. And an original Stradivarius, one that cost $2 million.
So after he played on these five violins, we asked the audience, which violin do you think was the Stradivarius? And actually, 113 participants in the audience thought that the fungal-treated violin, the Opus, was treated for 9 months, was the Stradivarius. And the Stradivarius only got 39 votes.
And can you talk me through how they sound different?
This was very, very clear from the beginning. I remember when we built the first violins, before they were even treated with a varnish, I remember my son, who was 7 at the time, and we were listening to these four different violins, and he could tell directly the difference between the non-fungal-treated violins and the fungal-treated violins. And the reason is quite simple. Due to the fungal treatment, obviously, the sound radiation is higher, so the violin also sounds louder. But something that's very special is that the dampening properties of the wood are increased by 200 to 400%. If the dampening properties of the wood are altered, then the high notes that are often irritating for the ear, and this is what my son said, he said, I don't like the first two violins because they hurt my ears, these high notes, they disappear. And this gives our violins really a warm and mellow sound, very similar to many Stradivariuses or Guarneris.
Now that you know how they sound different, if I play you two extracts, would you be able to tell which was the Stradivarius and which was the fungal-treated violin? My producer, Graya, played me these two clips, and I got it wrong. It was the first clip that we played that was the fungal wood. So it doesn't say much for my own musical training as a former violinist. I'm not sure why I preferred the first one. Perhaps it was just that I listened to it first and really enjoyed it, and then it made it hard to be objective. I don't know. I just got it wrong. Thanks this week to Frances Schwartz and Kathy Willis for joining us. And also thank you to Frances's research institute, EMPA, for letting us use the violin clips. You can find links to both their works on our website, guardian.com/podcast. This week, the podcast was presented by me, Hannah Devlin, and produced by Greya Jackson. If you want to get in touch with us, you can just email scienceweekly@theguardian.com. And now that's all said and done, I'll leave you with Beethoven and Frances's violin.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.